You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist here on Radio Albion. We are at the 9th of June, something like that, 2024. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson. And before I continue, I want to apologize for those people who have written me, whether on Patreon or elsewhere, and I have failed to get back to them. It's something I do. It's not a smart thing. It's not a good thing. But it's a weakness I have. It is not personal. I will get to you. So you have my apologies for that. Those of you who followed my work for some time know that I have a sporadic but significant interest in Anton Chekhov, the great Russian playwright. Chekhov died in 1904 and is notoriously difficult to pin down in terms of ideology or religion or anything like that. In my book, The Ancient Orthodox Tradition in Russian Literature, I have something on his story, The Cherry Orchard. I've referenced The Black Monk in more than one publication. Although I have not referenced a nervous breakdown, or sometimes it's called an attack of nerves. All short stories by the same author. In fact, I'll go so far as to say that Ward No. 6 is one of my favorite works of Russian literature. And only sporadically do I talk about it or write about it. But both the literary world and its approach to mental illness have been a tremendous interest of mine for a long time. Don't forget, psychology was a subset of philosophy for a long time. That's why they still get PhDs. Because it's difficult to talk about moral goodness without talking about the relationship between the will and the intellect, and hence the inner workings of the human mind. Now, modern or postmodern psychology is separate from that. And it's in that separation that we're going to discuss these issues today. It is an explicit separation between moral goodness on the one hand and the inner workings of the mind on the other. So the three stories I'm going to deal with, Ward No. 6, The Nervous Breakdown, and The Black Monk. If you've read my book on Russian literature, I spend quite a bit of time on Dostoevsky, which is not a crazy thing to do in a book like that. But so much of Russian literature is mischaracterized, deliberately or otherwise, in the West, so that anybody who's not a member of the Black Hundreds was a Russian liberal. And that's how they deal with, you know, sometimes I do that with Gogol. Gogol's my favorite writer of all time. He's nuts, which all great writers have to be. But Russian literature is a reaction to the imposition of the westernized utilitarian agenda imposed in the 18th century, usually by violence. The intelligentsia comes up quite a bit. We'll talk about that in a while, but these are the intellectual vehicles of this movement. And Dostoevsky's Underground Man, which is one of the great standards, I mean, Gogol came before him, but the great standards of mental illness in Eastern literature and mental illness. I mean, the stress is on the mental, not on the illness. What's being criticized is the notion that we are merely individuals, that we are not products to the past, we are not products of tradition, and therefore we owe nothing to it. And it functions, the ancient Greek understanding of love and strife, seeking our own self-interest, which is usually something to do with money or prestige, something that's easily convertible into happiness and pleasure. Jeremy Bentham tried to even subcategorize these into intensity, duration, many other things. Therefore, human life is predictable, and it is based on a few quantifiable drives that's inherent in everybody. Human life is predictable, therefore, it is driven by these impulses, and therefore his happiness is the result of these impulses of being successfully fulfilled. Talking about Adam Smith, Jeremy Bentham, Karl Marx, this was the core of it. And they had those suppositions in common. This is what the 18th century monarchs were attempting to impose on Russia. And Dostoevsky says in that great book, he says, "Since when, in the past thousands of years, has man acted exclusively out of self-interest? What about the millions of facts that show that men, deliberately and in full knowledge of what their interests were, spurned them and rushed into a different direction?" And he says that stubbornness and willfulness are stronger in these people than their interests. Challenging utilitarianism and this kind of materialism, Dostoevsky writes, "As far as I can make out, you've based your scale of advantages on statistical advantages, or averages, and scientific formulas thought up by economists. And since your scale consists of such advantages as happiness, prosperity, freedom, security, and all that, a man who deliberately disregarded that scale will be branded by you, and by me too, as a matter of fact, as an obscurantist and utterly insane. What's really remarkable is that all your statisticians, sages, humanitarians, when listing human advantages, insist on leaving out one of them, and never even allow for, and thus invalidating all of their calculations." We're going to get to exactly what that is over the next hour. Jeremy Bentham thought that he could quantify all pleasure, setting them up on a scale. So that means public policy would be dictated based on the achievement of such pleasures, practically possible given a diversity of individuals under his regime. And that would be the highest goal of human life and public policy. There's been thousands of variations of these things, especially in the 19th century. And they form what we call today the social sciences. But what is it? The one thing that they cannot allow for. And I'm quoting Dostoevsky again here. "That a man, always and everywhere, prefers to act in the way he feels like acting, and not in the way his reason and interest tell him." In other words, in the underground man, rationality only satisfies rational requirements. Desire is not necessarily a rational requirement. The problem with the social sciences is that they fail to take this sort of will to power in humanity seriously. And this same psychological problem shows up in Chekhov's work. I was inspired by Maria Gavrilova's 2013 paper on this topic, where she joins these same three Chekhov's short stories. And one of my favorites, as I've mentioned, is Ward Number 6. It's a mental ward, an older version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. They're watched over by a former soldier, Nikita, who doesn't have a evil bone in his body, but he does truly believe that to maintain order, it is necessary to beat these guys. "There are five of them here," he says, "only one of which is of noble rank. Each has its own tragedy of life, which led them to this sad outbuilding," that is to say, the ward itself. And I always wondered, you know, I actually have seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest very recently, And the character of Nurse Ratched is thought-provoking, because I don't think she's done anything wrong. Nurse Ratched is pretty much by herself. I think she has one or two bodyguards. They're not particularly big guys, and yet she's surrounded by a dozen certifiably insane men. Her harshness doesn't come from her personality. It comes from the necessity of her circumstances, and I think the same goes for Nikita here. One of the characters of the ward is Ivan Gromov, who came from a wealthy family, but the family lost everything. In fact, when his father was sent to prison, they were left destitute. And whatever money Gromov was able to make, he gave to his mother. One day, Gromov saw guards leading two prisoners in shackles along the street, and that made a tremendous impression on him. And he convinced himself that he should also be shackled and put in prison the same way. And that was a huge area of anxiety for him. Anticipating possible arrest, he stopped sleeping. So when the stove makers came, the landlady from whom Gromov was renting a room, he decided that it was the police who had found him, not stove makers. So in horror, Gromov, clearly paranoid, ran out into the street, where he was caught and sent to Ward Number 6. His neighbors in the ward are really a bizarre and motley group of people. One was a big fat guy who had long ago lost the ability to think and feel. Another was a tall, thin tradesman with red hair, did not participate in conversations, and a particular interest was the Jew, Moisikia, the fool, who went crazy 20 years earlier, because a fire burnt down his hat workshop. But he was the only patient that was allowed to leave the building and even go into the street. The fifth inhabitant of the ward was another tradesman, middle class, that once served at the post office. He always had a sly, devious expression on his face, that he had some very important secret, as Chekhov called it. Now, the doctor, Andrei Ragin, had a very pleasant peasant-style appearance. He was idiosyncratic. He arrived in the city where the ward is based, and because it was a charitable institution, it was in terrible condition. He was a very weak character and couldn't properly raised the money. He had an assistant, a paramedic, Sergei Sergeyevich, a man who believed that he was more knowledgeable than the doctor. He was a narcissist of a type. And the only person that Ragin really wanted to deal with was the postmaster, the only person in the city whose company he could tolerate. They hired another doctor. So now there are two doctors, very young man, Eugene Kubotov. Not necessarily competent. He looked up everything in his reference book whenever he was approached by a patient. But he envied Ragin and wanted to take his place. Now, Moisikia would just wander around. He was imitating the fool for Christ, but of course, being a Jew, he simply used that facade, and he would collect alms out in the street. And Ragin had asked Nikita to give the man boots. Gromov noticed the doctor and began to angrily accuse him of keeping healthy people locked up while crazy people roam free. So there was this discussion between Gromov, a patient, and Ragin. But this fascinated the doctor, and he decided to come back some other time and talk with him. In fact, Ragin began to regularly visit the ward, and it's where the doctor found his spiritual and intellectual outlet. Now, the hospital learned about his frequent visits to the ward, which apparently was frowned upon, but no one could understand why he went there, sat there for hours. He didn't prescribe anything. That was the only reason he would ever go there. And Kubotov thought very self-interestedly that Ragin had lost his mind himself, and that he noticed just from this rumor that his rival had started, that they looked at him and spread rumors. And there was even a town meeting, to see if this guy is sane or not. The only thing that caused this was one rumor spread by this second doctor that was hired, Mikhail Avryanich, who I've mentioned already, was asked to urge Ragin to go on a trip with him to relax and have some fun. Naively, he agreed. He traveled the country, went to St. Petersburg, Warsaw, and when he returns, of course, Kubotov has taken his place. His housing was based on the ward, so he had to find another place to live. But he realized that life was very calm. In fact, it suited him. Now, there was a lot of bad blood there, but Ragin still visited Gromov several times. Now, whether or not someone was considered insane came from the society as a whole. These town meetings, it's exactly what they did. Now, if you've been reading my stuff, you realize that that's what everyone does. Because mental illness isn't a physical disease, it's just a matter of what you perceive. It was a simple act of Ragin visiting with Gromov, who was highly intelligent, and that was sufficient for the townsfolk to begin spreading rumors about why was he speaking to this psycho. The townspeople were far more concerned with gossip than any kind of medical concern. So the town meeting, the council, had no ability, no competence to decide this. And even when they came with their so-called guilty verdict that he wasn't sane, they never even told him about it. And that everyone thought, as we mentioned with Nikita, that physical beatings were really the only way to keep these guys in line. Ragin, when he was the head of it, knew that this violence, systematic violence, in other words, it's not from the vice of one person, he was opposed to it, but didn't do much about it. Of course, he got the same treatment when he went from doctor to patient overnight. But clearly there had been a conspiracy from this second doctor, Kubotov, who was not necessarily competent and was very inexperienced. The only thing he knew was referencing terms, words, phrases, slogans from the official documents. There was no integrity, but robbery was everywhere. People, the patients, began to simply treat everyone else the same way that they were treated. One day, Ragin went to Kubotov and screamed at him. He asked his friend for forgiveness, the postmaster. And that was when, after he lost his job, that's when Kubotov managed to lure Ragin to the hospital and leave him there. Even Kubotov was told by Nikita he couldn't find. He went there, was going to lure him there. He was dressed up in a robe, and that was it. In fact, Ragin simply went to his bed and told himself there was really no difference between his little apartment, the room he rented, and ward number 6. But he clearly was not allowed to leave. Partially, it was his own lack of action as the doctor, the head of the hospital, that nothing really was ever done, that Nikita wasn't removed. The next day, after all this, he died of apoplexy, which I think translates to be a stroke of some kind. And no one showed up at the funeral. It's actually a very simple story about how incompetent but conformist people send others to either prison or, in this case, the mental ward. And there's not much of a distinction here. Now, many of you have heard me reference the Black Monk. The anti-hero is Covenant. This was written in 1894. He is visited by what clearly is a demonic apparition. And this demonic apparition says that through his, he's a student, through his knowledge of science and philosophy, he is the Antichrist. He is the new leader to bring humanity to its proper purpose. Thousands of years earlier than what evolution would have done, unaided. In a sense, Chekhov is a student of Nietzsche, which is clearly involved in this story. But it also brings the worship of science into very sharp relief. The intelligentsia in Russia was based around the idea of Darwinian progress. Covenant is told that through science, there is this coming age of utopian plenty, and it will soon show up. Clearly, this is a demon speaking to him. In fact, the self-conception of the Antichrist in Vladimir Solovyov's A Brief Tale of Antichrist, you see it almost identically in this book. So, quote-unquote, God has chosen a group of people on Earth to move evolution forward more quickly than normal, to create an order based on knowledge and the oligarchy of science that will solve the problems of temporal life. I've mentioned this with regard to Francis Bacon as well. So the apparition convinces Covenant that he is a scientific genius and that the people around him, the herd, the mass, don't understand people like him. Now, whether or not the apparition is real is unimportant, but clearly the narrator here is saying that he is mentally ill. But his mental illness in his mind comes from not being part of the herd. In fact, in an insane society, only the sane people will be considered insane. And he's told, however, that this is just more proof that he is going to bring peace and plenty to the world. This Nietzschean idea is modernity and progress. Covenant then marries a very pious, young, frail girl named Tanya. Usually in Russian literature, Russia is represented in a simple girl of some kind, usually one that ends up rejected or hurt. But she represents old Russia. She marries this anti-hero because she, very naive, is convinced that he is destined for greatness. And because her life isn't very meaningful, marrying him makes up for it. But someone like Covenant can't really marry anybody because everyone's his inferior. And he tortures her, driving her to despair, and eventually takes up with an older woman. And not long afterwards, a young man, Covenant, dies of a hemorrhage, another stroke. The apparition comes to him in his last moments of life and says, this death is necessary because even your body can't stand being or can't handle being controlled by such a genius. But the Slavophile school and its criticism of modernity you see in these two books, it's claimed that he is not much of a philosopher and he's not very abstract. But Ward number 6 and the Black Monk strongly argue for a anti-modernist view of the world. It's the impatience of the intelligentsia demanding the elimination of all boundaries for the sake of the ego. And only a constantly renewed world of illusion can maintain it. The fact that mental illness in Ward number 6 can be assigned to anybody for any reason, that the people on the inside are no different than the people on the outside, and that these diagnoses, not being based on any physical presence, there's no such thing as a schizophrenia tumor or something like that. It's a matter of arbitrary and capricious condemnation. A Nervous Breakdown is one of my favorites because it parallels the earlier Nevsky Prospect of Gogol. This was written in 1889, and the protagonist is Vasilev, who is a law student. his two friends, Meyer and Rybnikov, they convince him that they want to go through something called the Lane, the red light district of Moscow. And it's nothing but brothels here. And Vasilev begins to really feel very intensely for the women who are nothing more than slaves. And the fact that not only is there total indifference as to their fate, but they think that this is perfectly acceptable, the mass of the population. Even when he approaches some of these women as their liberator, they don't care. They have no interest in what he's trying to say. Their responses are one word and revolve around money. He tries to create a order in his mind about what kind of a place this is, and that all fails. Because again, reason can't be brought to bear on this kind of thing. He doesn't understand how this is different from slavery. A human being could be bought for a ruble, or at least rented. Now his friends, the other two students, one's a medical student, the other is an artist, they have no empathy. They're totally indifferent to what surrounds them. And that indifference derives from the view that everything is determined, and hence suffering as an inevitable part of our life, there's nothing you can do about it. And Vasilev can't handle this. He can't handle this total lack of empathy, especially when you're talking about very serious suffering here. And he confronts them about it. As they're going through this red light district, he gets more and more angry and dissociated. And his friends say, we human beings do murder each other, but no amount of philosophizing is ever going to help it. Apparently, Vasilev could reflect in his soul pure empathy, the suffering of others. And in fact, that suffering is not inherent because there is nothing that is merely inevitable. Against the concept that suffering is inevitable and therefore unavoidable, he says, oh, this is all so ordinary, prosaic, uninteresting. What is there in all of this rubbish? I could see now how this nonsense might tempt a normal man. That would make him omit the dreadful sin of buying a human being for a ruble. Sinning for the sake of magnificence, beauty, grace, passion, good taste, that I can understand. But this is something different. What's worth sinning for in this place? In other words, the girls themselves are getting nothing out of this. They finally return home. Vasilev is just overwhelmed with emotion. And clearly we learn that this is not his first nervous breakdown. And he comes up with all of these schemes to save the women there. They've been reduced to the status of animals, and that is unacceptable. 2 days later, he was thinking of killing himself. His friends referred him to Mikhail Sergeyevich, who actually is a well-known, famed doctor. And just, again, goes into how can anyone be indifferent to this? I'm considered insane because I'm advocating for these people, because I'm outraged by it. Many of you already know that Chekhov himself was an MD and worked throughout Russia. I mean, literary work was his primary concern. But Vasilev, in his confrontation with the psychologist, the psychologist's concern is only to control this mounting anger, despair. As a result, and this is probably the first expression of this problem, Mikhail Sergeyevich gives him a numerous sedatives. And when he takes them, the doubt goes away. It doesn't get answered. The problem is simply pushed to the back of the mind. His friends attacking him, Vasilev in his outrage, say, you think your head's full of great ideas and thoughts, don't you? Damned if I know what they are, but they're not ideas. You look at me now with loathing and disgust, but in my opinion, you do better building another 20 brothels like these than going around with a face like that. His prescriptions are bromide and morphine. And these eventually calm him down. In fact, his outbursts he feels a little bit bad about now. But clearly, this is Chekhov at his best. Mental illness as a psychological phenomenon is one thing, but he will not remove it from moral norms, which is something that psychiatrists or psychologists today could never do. Or they simply assume these guardrails that the regime puts in place. Psychiatrists in the day in Russia were trying to understand the Russian soul. And Chekhov is doing it from a literary and a psychological point of view. There's a complicated interconnection here between psychopathology of an ego on the one side and the anomaly you could find in the surrounding world on the other. So in these works, the anomalies, which are not really anomalies, the evils that we see socially can trigger insanity, as you see in Ward number 6. And insanity can be the reflection of or trigger for the evils of the world, as you see in The Black Monk. Chekhov shows that neither medicine nor social reform is prepared to understand it, the complexity of mental illness. It goes back to Dostoevsky. None of this is in the interest of the sufferer. Back then, you know, because only modernity brought mental illness, not the congenital kind, but this kind of personality disorder. He says that back then, a mentally unstable person is a weak-minded fool and therefore should be isolated. In fact, the author asks whether they should be treated whatsoever. There are no means at the time for treating the mentally ill without harming them. And there's no difference between the social and the individual in this respect either. He doesn't answer unambiguously. So this is a complex of three ideas. And as you've heard, all three have quite a bit in common. Ward number 6, one of my favorite works of literature of all time, secular literature anyway. This is a pinnacle of Chekhov's literary mind. And it starts off with the notion that the world, given how arbitrary it is cannot be lived in a rational way. That there's this alienation, this intense inner conflict that doesn't allow a man to love or to understand the people around him. Andrei Rogin, the main character of the story, the doctor, he does see the real world and realize it's insanity. You notice that he very much went along with the town and with his rival to go live in the asylum. And this came right after Vsevolod Godshin, who was the front page news in Russia at the time, who saw the injustice of the world and took refuge, so to speak, in insanity, eventually killed himself. So we're talking about two different concepts of mental illness, one that's socially based and the other that is clinical or allegedly biologically based. Now, Gromov, in Ward number 6, did have what everyone would consider to be a persecution mania, as we've mentioned in the beginning. But Gromov is also, from the literary point of view, he is the conduit for Chekhov as a person. But what Gromov says is that human nature can be exposed, at least in modernity, by realizing, and I'm quoting here, that society has no higher interests. It leads a dull, meaningless life, finding diversion and violence, coarse depravity and hypocrisy. Scoundrels are sleek and well-dressed, while honest men feed on crumbs. Well, there's nothing really new about that. But you can't claim to be an enlightenment society. And he's not just talking about Russia. He's talking about modernity in general. The reason that Gromov simply allows this to happen to him is that this realization will lead to a course of action in his mind that would be considered mentally ill. This is a consequence, this so-called illness, is a consequence of his heightened ability to see past the appearances and what people say and to recognize the basis and foundation of the human condition. Of course, that's what we do here every week. On the other hand, the second type is rooted in the essence of human existence. Because of intense alienation, the lack of harmony and understanding, and in fact, Chekhov includes atheism in this, you now have a social universal insanity, a deeply alienating way of not so much of thought, but of action. He uses a few symbols, which are very important, bromide, which I've already mentioned. It shows up in all three of these stories. And this was the very beginning of the medical approach to mental illness, and Chekhov was extremely skeptical of it. Throughout, Chekhov at least expressed serious doubts that drugs in general could work. With Vasilev, you see, he was given both of these drugs. They were both sedatives. And his problems with the prostitutes just went away. Well, they didn't really go away. But Ragin in Ward number 6 and Kovrin, the black monk, are both prescribed bromide. Which, for the most part, is condemned in the corpus of Chekhov's works. And this was just the very beginning of the use of chemicals to treat what's called mental illness. Now, bromide being prescribed it signifies a fork in the road, a turning point, where the doctor's world shifts from being healthy to being sick, despite the fact nothing changed in the meantime. His rival, Kubotov, is very careful to make sure that Ragin takes his bromide. Again, visiting patients is such a bizarre thing back then. He thinks he has to visit his sick colleague all the time. Kubotov is continuously bringing more bromide on every visit. So the more he's prescribed, the worse he gets, which clearly is no accident, since this is a young doctor that wanted to take his place. Bromide to Ragin is just a constant reminder of what he is. In fact, the bromide prompts nervous attacks and making anxiety and dissociation even worse. In other words, the young doctor is deliberately making him seem insane by these prescriptions and thus justifying his position. In a nervous breakdown, Vasilev clearly is a sensitive young man. He over-concentrates. He overthinks him, to use our term. And in the process, completely exhausts himself. Bromide shows up there too, and only shows up at the end of the story. So Vasilev goes from the overly emotional, albeit mentally unstable man. He leaves the doctor's office with two prescriptions, bromide and morphine, or opium. There's nothing new here. As far as Vasilev is concerned, he's been through this before. But when that happened and over what, Chekhov doesn't really get into. He is officially insane, of course not institutionalized. But as he says, the only real reason for his being considered that is his confrontation of everybody else for not wanting to do something about prostitution. Bromide in the Black Monk tends to be connected with dullness. We use the word bromide not as a chemical. Most of the time we use the term to refer to a prosaic, mediocre thing. The Black Monk, it doesn't have the powerful effect like it does in Ward number 6 in a nervous breakdown. There, it's essentially a treatment for what everyone seems to think is a mental illness. The demon can be real, and he's mentally ill at the same time. Those aren't contradictory. It may have helped his illness, but it eventually destroyed him. Because once the bromide works, and he's able to get back to some semblance of everyday life, he falls apart. total spiritual degradation, as he says. Anyone who's involved in his treatment is condemned. In other words, why my insanity was a good thing. It exposed the world. What do I want to be sane for? That the bromide dulled his senses, cut off his connection with the intellect and the so-called spiritual world. The two worlds of Kovrin, one with the black monk and the world of his without him, without that alleged realization. A bromide is an interesting symbol, late 19th and early 20th centuries. Potassium bromide was used as a sedative. Plenty of people have attempted to diagnose Kovrin, something along the lines of schizophrenia. But this stuff was just getting published and getting into the intellectual circles. Korsakov, 1893 reference book, is one of these. And along with the development of psychology comes the development of drugs, this being a very early version of it. But you read this short story, and it seems that Kovrin was a healthy man, albeit narcissistic. The bromide is what pushed him over the edge. His life collapses only when the treatment succeeds. Bromide, it stopped what most people thought were hallucinations, but it just makes him depressed. He doesn't see the black monk anymore. Maybe he's not mentally ill at all. Chekhov seems to suggest that he wasn't mentally ill in the first place, meaning that the black monk was actually real. So drugs and its connection with what's considered insanity or mental illness, you find in all three stories. As I've already hinted, the concept of the intelligentsia is also found in all three. That's why my book on the ancient Orthodox tradition, my work on Chekhov and Gogol, what I'm doing right now, is to say that Russian literature is intensely social and political. Both, or I should say all of, these anti-heroes, Kovrin, Uragin, and Vasilev, are all members of the intelligentsia. And what do we mean by that? It's a term that really developed and became popular in both the Polish and the Russian context. It's not just someone who's an intellectual, but it's something very similar to nihilism. It's a complex of attitudes, which includes militant atheism and total determinism, and hence an opposition to the church and the royal state. And they also have some vague connection with socialism and this mystique of violent revolution. What matters here is that the intelligentsia is deeply detached and alienated from society as a whole. The peasantry, the lower middle classes, of course, the church, these are essentially important institutions. But the intelligentsia is usually, especially in the sense we're using the term, is urban and Jewish to a great extent. You had this intellectual elitism along with their sense of being Messiah. Isaiah Berlin, I think I've cited this before, back in the 2013 edition of his book, Russian Thinkers, talking about the intelligentsia, he says, "The phenomenon itself, with its historical, literally revolutionary consequence, is, I suppose, the largest single Russian contribution to social change in the world. The concept of intelligentsia must not be confused with the notion of intellectual. Its members thought of themselves as united by something more than a mere interest in ideas. They conceived themselves as being a dedicated order, almost a secular priesthood, devoting to the spreading of a specific attitude to life." That specific attitude, of course, is violent revolution based on the sacred ideal of progress. Talking about modernity without talking about progress is like talking about American politics without mentioning the Jews. Progress centered and focused everything that we, in a very general sense, may term leftism. It's the same thing as nihilism. Of course, the Narodniks, These are all extremely violent. No conception of their own limitations. They're urban and often from the wealthier classes. These are usually intellectuals. And Bulgakov, for example, says that this is the creation of Peter the Great. And his famous line, the window through Europe that St. Petersburg was supposed to be, it may be vivifying, but it's also toxic at the same time. The fact that Chekhov is setting himself against them suggests that, in fact, he's rejecting this concept of modern progress. But this cuts someone off from the community around you. In all these stories, you have three educated characters alienated from the world around them. And all three of them seem to have a basic disorder that Michael Hoffman have called aboulia in the past. Fatigue, a lack of motivation, along with feelings of inadequacy and psychosomatic conditions. And in Nagin's case, in Ward number 6, the village is completely alien from him, as are his patients. It's only another member of the intelligentsia where he finds any kind of satisfaction. Same thing for Vasilev. He's condemning them for abusing their social status. He even says, just as these men, having bought women, will leave them later and consider themselves still an artist or a scientist, as if those roles don't have a moral center. In fact, the black monk with Kovrin builds his megalomania, which is also his alienation from society. And of course, this does nothing more than further isolate him from the world in the broader sense, not in the Christian sense. The concept, the Nietzschean concept that madness is linked to genius. And the black monk made Kovrin insane, but it also reinforced the idea that he was a genius. And if you're a genius and you have this very specifically, almost a grace-filled insight into the world, there's no act of violence that you aren't allowed to commit. Now, Chekhov wrote a letter to Vsevolod Myrkold, 1899. He said, Kovrin's nervousness should not be emphasized, or else the neuropathological nature will obscure and overwhelm the more important, namely his loneliness, but the kind of loneliness experienced only by great and otherwise healthy organisms. In mass society, the only truth is untruth. In other words, what Chekhov is saying is that Kovrin's illness, his nervousness, it's not a clinical matter. It's not a condition of what we would call mental illness. It is something that derives from the social order itself. And by that, he's not talking about the monarchy. He's talking about modernity. We're even at a point here, at the very end of the 19th century, that mental illnesses were becoming fashionable. In fact, Chekhov even denies, of course, the name for it was neurasthenia, this disease mostly at the mental, socioeconomic, and psychological levels. He says maybe it doesn't exist at all. And even if it does, it should not be considered a disease. The doctor in a nervous breakdown, when he's examining Vasilev, talks about his exhaustion. His patient's exhaustion. When he goes in there after his outburst concerning the prostitutes, they test his skin sensitivity, his reflexes, and of course say, well, he may have neurasthenia. Black monk, it's mostly about his megalomania. And there it says, Andrei Kovrin, master of arts, was overworked and his nerves were upset. And that explains his hallucination. You have the concept of degeneration, which is the opposite of progress. And it was already fairly well known by the time Chekhov began writing. And here is a social foundation for mental illness. He was a Jewish author, Max Nordau. That gifted people are often subject to psychological illness. degeneration in his case refers to deviations from the norm. Things like prominent talent, criminal tendencies, sexual perversion. Remove one from the mainstream and thus increase the chances of an illness or a personality disorder based around this alienation. But degeneration, as Nordau would say, is really the connected to the development of civilization as such, in the sense that the cities provide and offer a life that is so bizarrely unnatural. It moves so quickly. I've mentioned this several times in the past, that driving a car requires a massive number of calculations that the ancients, medievals had no conception of, or even people 150 years ago had no conception of. But these very same people, this comes right out of Nietzsche, these very same people have a tremendous sensitivity to music and the arts. And they take that as their difference from being an ignoramus. Kovrin goes so far as to say that these are unhappy men, that they don't realize that their coarse nerves are incapable of comprehending beauty. So Kovrin is very similar to that mad genius of Nietzsche and Nordau. That Kovrin, when he's listening to music, listening to singing, that's what is the precursor to seeing his hallucination. In other words, it comes from the excitement generated by music, very easily stimulated. Even so, like the scent of flowers sends him into euphoria or depression or something like that with equal ease. So you see how psychology and the criticism that so many, myself and so many others have launched on it, because it has no physical foundation, it's whatever the regime wants it to be. Atheism in Chekhov is one of the results of this mentality. Atheism symbolizes mental instability. Ragin and Moisika, the Jew, are both atheists. They reject the concept of certainty. They reject the concept of logos. In fact, Ragin at one point wanted to go to the seminary, but his father, as I mentioned, also a doctor, a surgeon, mocked him so vehemently that if he became a priest, he would be thrown out of the family. Despite the fact that Ragin had, you know, icons and things like that in his office, he didn't believe in any of it. He's not a believer. But even if he were, he doesn't have the strength of will to impose it on anybody. It's a very subtle treatment of religion, the church, spirituality. Moisika, Ward number 6, the Jew, is, again, another parody. The mockery, the Jewish mockery of the holy fool. But more importantly, Mosaica is the Jewish mind. As I mentioned, he used to be a haberdasher, destroyed in a fire 20 years earlier. His constant obsession with raising money is just to exploit other patients on the ward. The whole purpose of him raising money is to get out of there. Begging for money has nothing to do with rebuilding his store. It's to be able to finance his escape. Moiseka is constantly abandoning truth for the sake of falsehood. His atheistic greed is hidden by the explicit attempt to try to act like a holy fool. And if you've heard me in the last few months talk about the holy fool phenomenon, I can't remember when exactly that was. But this is no good for the Jew because he lives in constant fear that he's going to be caught and permanently locked up. His rejection of logos is the cause of his rejection of any kind of morality. And one of the core motifs here in Ward number 6 is that fear is one of the things that lead directly to insanity. The concept of indifference, and here we're not talking about the Stoic idea, but someone like Ragin, the doctor, he has no interest. He is completely alienated from his occupation and his patients. Kovrin does the same thing for his wife and his family. And Vasilev wants no social interaction anymore because of everything that he has discovered. One trip to the red light district. But indifference isn't this Stoic concern. it's far more pathological than that. You know, that Arguin is indifferent, so he doesn't have to face the reality of his institution and the corruption of the workplace, which is clear in the text. The black monk, Krovrin, used indifference to avoid sharing Pesotsky's passion for the garden, and hence calm his neurotic thoughts. These are all ways of escaping reality. So Krovrin, before he goes into a seizure, which is one of the things he's stricken with, if he concentrates his mind on one thing and keep it there, he will avoid the seizure. So gardening is something that helps him do that. However, he doesn't want to do that. The cure is worse than the disease. If he focuses on something, you have this piece of indifference coming back. But it's the only way that he could return to a normal life. But normal life is what he hates. Vasilyev has this obsession with building a social order that will not permit the existence of prostitution. This has as much to do with him as anything else. All are indifferent to the practical realities. His plans have no basis in reality. It has more to do with making himself feel better. Indifference seems to be connected to fear. And you see it in all three of these stories. They don't accept, but they also don't resist the reality of their own existence. The concept of narcissistic superiority is also very important. The worst thing that someone can be is mediocre. Accepting mediocrity is, in fact, to be mediocre. And people sometimes mischaracterize what narcissism is. Narcissism isn't just the simple belief that I deserve more than everybody else. It's not this pure delusion that I am so extraordinary that everyone should kneel before me. No, and this is what separates the narcissist from the sociopath. He knows that he is nothing but mediocre. He knows that he's a member of the mass. He knows that he doesn't have the ability to break through it. But he has to bury it. And therefore, he lives in constant fear that somehow his fraud is going to be exposed. Chekhov will say that in contrast to this, it's the ordinary person that is the backbone of everything. It's the very practical concerns that make them both mediocre and allow society to function. They're not members of the intelligentsia. They don't resist the reality surrounding them. And this is what saves them from going insane. Books also have another alienating effect. In fact, all the characters, especially in Ward No. 6 and The Black Monk, all the characters are voracious readers. Gromov reads pretty much anything he can get his hands on, but Arguin has a specific agenda in his reading. Chekhov writes that you could see as he's reading in his face, he wasn't really reading, he was devouring. He just wanted to go through as much as he possibly could. In fact, again, when he was the head doctor there, half his salary went to buying books. It was a joy for him. It wasn't an impulsive thing. But enjoying language as such. Gromov and Arguin and Ward No. 6 are very similar people. But they're on both sides, either side of the fence, so to speak. The black monk couldn't have convinced Krovrin anything unless he had read about this concept of progress and who could bring about the fulfillment of evolution. And reading about this stuff, becoming a member of the intelligentsia, does, among other things, alienate you irredeemably from the world around you. this intellectual narcissism. But people who are well-read, and this was known in Russia at the time, no matter how altruistic your mentality, being a scholar, they called in Russia brain workers, Mozgovny and Robotnik, they didn't gain anything from this. I mean, I could have told you that. These so-called brain workers, hardworking, intelligent, often physically unfit, has a total lack of freedom, and wants to serve people, but cannot. Gromov, Regin, Kovrin, Vasilev, they're all in this category. Ward number, actually, you see it in all three stories. Bars on the window or the fence in The Black Monk. A nervous breakdown. The bars and walls are symbols of mental illness. A mental hospital is made by bars. It's not really a hospital. It's more like an isolation ward. It's essentially a prison. It isn't to cure them. It's to protect everybody else on the outside. The institutions, ward number 6, even a nervous breakdown to some extent, it's to keep those who have declared war on society, for better or for worse, from intermingling with that society. Mental illness in ward number 6 comes from perceiving the truth. I think you've figured that out by now. There's both the physical bars and walls in the institution and the mental prisons that we were raised with. The sick and healthy have to live together. The doctor and the patient now are on the same side of the fence. The bars are located from the outside of the ward, but it determines what's sane and what isn't. There's a prison of the world's values and expectations. The one good thing, though, you see this in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that when you're in an asylum, the regular expectations, hard work and all that, it's not expected from you. It's actually a much easier life so long as you remain more or less mediocre. The hospital, the ward, the fence, whatever the metaphor is, it has to do with the extreme levels of alienation, the main characters from their environments. Environments that are not directly Orthodox, but also not completely secular. But there's no difference between ward number 6 and a prison. In fact, Chekhov, he just got back from Sakhalin Island, and he wrote, as a doctor, he visited it, and he visited the mentally ill section. And he said, the mentally ill, as I've already mentioned, have no separate quarters on Sakhalin. While I was there, some of them were quartered in Korsakov's colony, along with the syphilitics, and I was told that one even caught syphilis. The others, they lived freely, worked alongside the healthy, cohabitated with them, eventually escaped, and were at that point convicted of a crime. So some of the most powerful elements here, if not the most powerful element, is the idea of alienation. The bars and fences that appear in these stories separating one group from another. What's the connection between curing and physical isolation? Chekhov seems to deny the very existence of mental illness in any biological sense. The intelligentsia creates its own cult based on atheism, a basic indifference, superiority, and clearly an over-reliance on books. Chekhov seems to believe that mental illness is, at least mostly, not physiological, but is a matter of the social and economic system. Mental illness, for the most part, is a product of the social whole. One of the things that Chekhov mentions is that those who've avoided mental illness, no matter what side of the fence they're on, I mentioned Pesotsky's garden. Something like that is exactly what keeps people from insanity. Kolbotov, as evil as he is, his profession, whether he's competent or not, is what keeps him from going crazy. Even Vasily's friend. The key thing that they have in common is that none of these characters are distracted by larger questions. They have to live in denial. That's the only way to live in modernity at all. They're not as empathetic as Vasilev, and therefore will not suffer from the evils of the world. They filter the truth of existence. Environmental factors push to the brink of insanity, although in a different way. But still, even if those environmental factors were removed, mental illness will still exist. You can't eradicate mental illness. It's an aspect of the human condition. It helps us cope with reality when everything else fails. In fact, it is a coping mechanism. This gradual movement from normal to insane, as bizarre as it is in some of these cases, they unveil the theme of insanity. That neither psychiatry nor social systems has any capability of offering any assistance here. Ragin says in Ward Number 6, since prisons and madhouses exist, well, someone has to sit in them. Society is invincible, as a doctor would say. It's invincible so long as it protects itself from criminals, the mentally ill, and generally inconvenient people. Of course, Ragin turns out to be one of these inconvenient people. He didn't think that medicine had any connection with psychiatry. Like other doctors of his era, he doesn't know the proper treatment of this sort of thing. But he knows certainly that there isn't just one thing. It's not a matter of prescribing anything. But medicine and society seem helpless in the face of mental illness. They are, in fact, completely inconvenient people. And all three of these stories, all of these variables are brought to bear. And the one thing that seems to save anyone from it is a very practical and ordinary approach to something that you're good at. Anyway, I've gone way over here. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.